Hi, and welcome to the Friday Coffee Meetup podcast for Friday, September 13th, 2019. On today's episode, we'll hear from Maria, who is an early stage investor at Sound Ventures, on how VCs think about early stage investing. The Friday Coffee Meetup podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory, a Pasadena-based marketing and advertising agency that specializes helping healthcare, consumer goods, clean tech, and aerospace companies achieve rapid, sustainable growth. Echo Factory CEO Mike Schaefer is a co-founder and organizer of Friday Coffee Meetup. If you're interested in how Echo Factory can help your company achieve rapid, sustainable growth, you can learn more at echo-factory.com. Every week, the Friday Coffee Meetup brings together innovators, startups, investors, tech companies, and entrepreneurs at the cross-campus co-working space in Pasadena. You can learn about upcoming meetups and how you can attend in person at fridaycoffeemeetup.com. Now, here's Maria with this week's presentation.
Hello. I'm Maria. All of you guys have such interesting backgrounds. I'm really excited to talk to you guys all afterwards. Okay. So I think what we're going to cover today is we're going to talk a little bit about early stage investing and how early stage venture investors try to identify new opportunities. Before we get into that, maybe it'll be helpful if I share a little bit about Sound Ventures and then also a little bit about my background because it's not a traditional path to venture capital. So Sound Ventures is a $150 million early stage venture fund. So early stage means a lot of different things to different people, but we primarily focus on Series A and Series B investing. Our average check size is $2 million up to $5 million, but a core part of our investment strategy is that we don't lead rounds. We come on as follow-on investors, and I can explain more about that in a little bit. So we're a $150 million fund. Our investment strategies that we invest, we're very generalist. So we'll invest in consumer, B2B, and within those broad verticals, anything and everything. So fintech, govtech, healthcare, retail, e-commerce, sort of you name it, and we'll invest in it. Really what we're looking for is teams that have incredible passion, drive, grit, big market opportunities, and something that's different or some way for a company to have a competitive advantage and maintain a competitive advantage over time. Broadly speaking, that's kind of what we look for. Just in terms of the fund background, because I think it's always helpful. So the fund was started in 2015 by Ashton Kutcher and Guy Osiri. So Ashton's the actor. Guy Osiri runs Maverick, which is one of the largest artist management companies in the world. So they started angel investing together over a decade ago. And then in 2010, they raised a fund called A-Grade. A-Grade, they invested from 2010 till 2014. That was the fund that invested in companies like Uber, Airbnb, Spotify, Warby Parker, Pinterest, House, sort of like you name it. Then in 2015, they raised institutional capital. And so that's when they raised for Sound Ventures, and they kind of rebranded the fund. So even though the Sound itself has only been around since 2015, the team has been investing, the investment philosophy has been around since about like 2010. So that's a little bit about Sound. In terms of me, so I joined the team a little 2.5 years ago. So there's about six of us on the investment side, three partners, three investment professionals. I joined 2.5 years ago. I actually came from the LP side. So LPs are limited partners that invest in venture funds. So just how you have investors, venture funds have investors. And so I actually came from that side. So traditionally, most people who come into venture come from either an operator role or iBanking or some type, like you were an Minnie over here was an operator before she joined a venture fund. So it's traditionally more finance related. For me, it was more about, I come from the LP side and wasn't doing a lot of direct investing into companies, but spent a lot of time just getting to know the ecosystem and the market. And then I was at my last job for 5 years and then ended up joining Sound Ventures 2.5 years ago. So it wasn't very traditional, but somehow I got here. Okay, so let's get into like raising venture capital. So there's a few things to think about before you start raising venture capital. And the first thing that I want to mention is that not everyone who has a startup needs to raise venture capital, right? There's lots of other different ways to finance your business. Venture capital is just one option for you. And so the things that I would think about is One, before you start raising venture capital, think about what you can prove with your market or with your idea or whatever it is without needing to raise additional capital. Like today, there's so many different software tools and solutions that you can actually use to start building a product that weren't necessarily there 10 years ago, right? So AWS now lets you do cloud computing, you know, and start building companies, whereas before you actually had to build the physical network infrastructure in order to start a company, right? So that already makes it easier. And then you have all of these different software tools that you can build on top of. So one thing that I always recommend is before you start raising capital and raising capital from institutions like venture funds is think through what can you actually prove out about your idea before you go out to raise capital. And the reason I say that is because when you raise institutional capital and when you raise from other investors, your outcomes just become, like, need to be so much bigger, right? So I'll give you an example. It's like, if you raise capital, you know, $1 million at, call it a $5 million valuation from institutional investors, you need to have an outcome that is much bigger than 20 million, 30 million, 40 million, right? Because those investors who are investing in you are looking for minimum 5 to 10x returns. So the minute that you raise institutional capital, your outcomes just get pushed out much further, which is great, right? Some companies, like, they can become multi-billion dollar companies, but it's important to remember that just when you're thinking about raising and whether it's the right fit for you. The other thing I would think about is, that's about how big this can get. And then also just around managing expectations. So what's your ideal exit, right? So if you own, call it 80 to 90 to 100% of a company and it exits for $20 million, that's a great outcome for you. But is it a great outcome for your investors? And so managing those expectations when you get venture capital is, like, super important, because what might be a great financial exit for you might not be a great financial exit for your investors. And oftentimes they can actually, depending on the term sheets and stuff like that, they can actually block you from doing specific things like selling early, right? Because they want to maximize their returns. So all of this to say, just take this all into consideration when you're raising. And I would think about that before needing to raise, because not every business needs to raise. Like, there are great companies that have been built on raising very, very little capital. Like, one that comes to mind is Zapier. Zapier is like an if-this-then-that platform that connects different software tools. I think they ended up raising in 2014, coming out of Y Combinator, the accelerator in the Bay Area. They raised $1 million, and they're currently at a $300 million revenue run rate. And, like, they never had to raise additional capital. And so, like, For that company, it was great because they were able to take just a very small amount and actually build something out. And so I would always think about that when you're looking to raise. Like, what do you actually need to raise? And how does that align with your expectations? Okay, so maybe let's just quickly, because it seems like you guys kind of know a little bit about venture, but maybe we can just run through this super quickly. So the different types of funds that there are. So when you're starting off in the early days, you're going to go to angel investors who write very, very small check, often are operators, often are institutional, are writing small checks, aren't institutional, but they can be very, very helpful for making introductions, helping you think through your business, whatever it might be. So angel, I would say angel investors and pre-seed investors typically write smaller checks at the very, very early stages of companies, and typically that capital is used to create what's called an MVP, a minimum viable product. And it's basically the lowest hanging fruit, basically, in terms of, like, proving out that this business can actually work. It doesn't have to be a great product. It has to just be, like, the bones and infrastructure of the core thing that you're going to be building. So then you have, after angel and pre-seed, then you have your seed. Let's just talk about seed for a second. So seed rounds can range anywhere from, like, call it, you know, maybe $1 million up to $3 million. And there's different types of funds that can invest there. So 10110 here, they do seed investing for enterprise SaaS. Basically, the point is that that's going to be your seed is typically your first institutional capital. And so those are your, like, traditional venture fund investors. And then usually that capital is used to build out a team and then also show product market fit. And so for product, probably, I mean, product market fit is, like, a very loosely defined term, but typically it's meant to just show that this is a viable product. People will pay for it or people will use it. And there's actually like a way for you to reasonably acquire customers. So that's your seed. And I would say that in each round, roughly, you're going to sell about, call it 15 to 25% of your business. So there's a difference between lead investors and follow-on investors. So lead investors are the ones who basically price the round is what we call it. And that means that they set a valuation on it. So like, let's say you need to raise $2 million. The lead investor is going to come in and say, okay, for $2 million, you know, I'll take 20% of the business and we're going to value this business at $10 million. And that's the role of the lead investor. Where was I going with that? I'm just rambling. Okay. And then follow on. So lead investors typically have ownership thresholds. And so they want to own anywhere from 15, 20, 25, 30% of your company. And so the way that I would think about this is for every single subsequent round that you do, you're going to sell between 15 to 30% of your company, depending on sort of where you're at and how you can negotiate it. And the lead investor is going to take most of that and they're going to be the ones who price it. And then typically the way that it works is like, so let's say the lead investor takes 20% of the round, then you want to sell 25%. So the remaining 5% ownership of your equity in your company is going to go towards follow-on investors. And so that's groups like Sound Ventures. So we won't come in and we won't tell you what value your company, we won't give you a valuation for your company, but we will let someone else price it and then we'll come on as part of that round. So that's okay. That's seed. And then series A and series B typically are much larger rounds. So those are going to be anywhere from call it 5 million to 10 million to 15 to 20. And at those stages, mostly what investors are looking for is post product market fit. And then how is this company going to scale? And so those are really your early indications or early days of scaling. So like, let's say at the seed, if you want to raise, if you're an enterprise software business, you're going to be maybe at like $1 million in ARR, annual recurring revenue. And so that's you have $1 million worth of contracts every year coming in subscription revenue. At the Series A and Series B, if you want to raise capital, you're going to be at like a 10, 15, 20, like some multiple of that. And there's a high velocity of growth and an indication that you actually have all the pieces in place in order to start scaling the business. So that means like team, sales, finance, all of that is kind of in place. And then Series C and later, I mean, that's just a whole other ball game. That's going to be your like in massive growth mode. You're like Uber and taking over every single country in the entire world. And so those are much different investors. So typically the way that venture funds work is that each fund kind of has a specific niche focus. So you have your pre-seed and seed investors. We're a Series A and Series B investors, which is like a very defined category. And then you have your growth investors. And so when you're going out to fundraise, one thing that I recommend that everyone do is just know your audience, right? Like know that like I'm probably not the right person for you to talk to if you're pre-launch, pre-product market fit, because we don't invest at that stage. Or like if you don't want to talk to a growth fund if you're a Series A company. So just managing those expectations and knowing that before you go into meetings is super helpful. Okay, so the three things that early stage investors look for. So team, market size, product. So within team, probably the most important thing to us, at least at Sound, is domain expertise. Like, what have you done in this space, or what do you know about it, or why do you care about it, and what makes you the right person to build this platform or this product, whatever it is. So it's like if you're an ex-Microsoft engineer, but now you're building this men's skincare brand, I don't know if I can see that domain expertise there. And so understanding like where you're coming from and why you're the only one who can solve this problem is super important. The other things that I think are super important for us when we're trying to identify a team, so grit and then also charisma. And so the reason why I say charisma is because you're selling not just to investors, you're selling to your customers and you're selling to the team that you're trying to recruit. And so if you don't have charisma or that salesmanship, it's really hard to build a great big company. In terms of TAM, so that's total addressable market, So what basically we look for is like really big markets. So if you're tackling, I was looking at this like vertical farms in corporate offices, and it was like a really interesting idea because like they basically put that you can grow different types of vegetables actually in the office. But then I was looking at it, and like the market size of how much people are actually spending on that is like $600 million. So if you can get a market that's only $600 million, you can only be as big of as a $600 million company. So it's not very interesting. So what we're looking for is really big markets. So think like multi-billion, over $10 billion, $50 billion, $1 trillion. That's the kind of market that we want to go after, because if you can even get a small percentage of that, you can still build a really big business. So the way that I would think about it is, okay, how big could my business be if I owned 100% of it? And how big could it be if I owned 10% of it? Both of those numbers should be really, really big. The other thing that we think about with TAM, with market size, is, okay, not just what the market is today, but what the market could be. So I'll use Uber as an example again. So when Uber started out, right, their market TAM wasn't just how much was being spent on taxis. Their market TAM was what everyone was spending on transportation. And so they grew that taxi market pie as a whole, as part of the transportation pie. And so companies that can do that or open up new markets are super, super interesting. So I would think about those two things when you're just figuring out how big your business can get. The third one, I would say at the early stages, is probably surprisingly the least important, because that if you have a great team and a really big market, you can still have a really good outcome and you can kind of iterate on the product over time. So I would say that that's probably the most flexible at the early stages. The team and TAM, I would say, are not very flexible. You need to have a great team and a big market. But the things that we look for in the product is like, how does this solve the current problem? Why is this better than existing solutions? What is the go-to market strategy? So are you going after small, medium SMBs or enterprise? What does that sales cycle look like? Understanding all of those factors and why you're set up to win is super important and something that we look for. So I'm just going to run through this very quickly, and then we can do Q&A. These are very basic, just like things to do and things not to do. So one, if you're going to send a deck, only send a PDF, only send a DocSend. If you're going to send a PDF, don't send an 80 megabyte file or larger. Make sure that it's something that can easily be opened on mobile. Because that's where most of us are reading our pitch decks. We're reading it on our phone. And so it has to be something super convenient and really easy. I would keep your slide deck to under 20 slides. If you can't explain why this is interesting in 20 slides, you're probably too verbose. I would say 20 is like even the max. I like slides that are like 15. And so you do team, TAM, product, and then you can talk a little bit about your go-to market strategy or like how your company's going to grow. Don't reach out to multiple partners at a firm. And so there's been multiple times where someone's reached out to me, then someone's reached out to one of my partners, and then reached out to someone else. When you're going into a venture fund, you're pretty much like, there's going to be one advocate for you on that team. And so when you try to go through multiple people, no one has actual ownership of like getting your deal through our pipeline. And so what you really want to do is you want to find that one person and that one advocate and then go with them. So I mean, I would always just reach out to one person. If they decide to pass, or like if they decide they don't want to take the meeting, fine, you can reach out to other people. But reaching out to multiple people simultaneously is never a good look. If you're going to make introductions, always double opt in. Make sure that both parties want to connect, because everyone's time is very precious. Keep your email simple and to the point. And so if an investor or someone has 20 seconds to read your email, in 20 seconds, what can you write that catches their attention or gets the point across on why they should care? So make a deck. Well, so one, send the deck beforehand, because before you meet with an investor, it just makes their life so much easier. So usually what I do when I'm in meetings is I'll go through the deck beforehand, and then on the call, we'll talk about all the things that I actually care about. Because after reading the deck, you have an overview of the business, and you kind of know what areas you want to focus on. So if you can send them the deck beforehand, then it's a better use of everyone's time, because they know what questions they need answered, and you can just go ahead and answer them. So it's almost like you're getting past that first intro call and just getting right into it. So I always recommend sending the deck beforehand. I also, and this varies person to person, but for me personally, I don't like it when founders just walk me through the slide deck and, you know, they're reading off the entire page and then they're just basically repeating what I can see. I'd rather spend the time if we have only 30 minutes, if we only have an hour, let's spend that time actually getting to know each other, getting to know what's in the business, which is also why it's important to send the deck beforehand. Because otherwise, then I'm just reading this deck that I could probably, you're just reading this deck to me that I could have read by myself. When you're fundraising, don't create artificial time constraints. So, you know, if your round isn't going to close for 3 months, or you're still looking for a lead investor, don't tell investors that you need to know by next week, otherwise they're out, or like give them this time pressure, because you don't know what's happening within their firm or what deals they're working on. And so if they are really busy at that time and they just can't prioritize your investment, then maybe it's like you'll lose out on the opportunity to work with them, even though it was just a byproduct of the situation. And so I always think being very realistic and candid with people about the time constraints that you're on is super helpful. And the more that you create like this artificial pressure, I mean, at least for us here at Sound, it most more often than not means that we won't continue the work, just because we like to get all of our diligence done and we don't like to, you know, not answer all the questions that we have. Okay, when you're meeting with investors, always have an ask, whether it's an introduction to someone, an advice on something, or if you're fundraising, ask for what you're looking for. This is interesting. Okay, so co-founders. So, you know, remember how I was mentioning earlier about knowing what outcomes you want? One thing that I've noticed is founders who have co-founders who, in the context of meeting with both of them and spending time with both of them, it becomes blatantly obvious that they have very different expectations on what the outcomes of the business should be. So you have one founder who wants to build this into a really nice $20 million, $50 million business and sell it to Microsoft. And then you have another co-founder who wants to make this into a multi-billion dollar business and wants to continue raising venture capital and and diluting themselves and just build a really big business. And so one thing, if you do have a co-founder, just make sure that you guys are 100% aligned on outcomes. 100% aligned, like, hey, if we got an offer for $100 million, we're going to just take it. Or, like, hey, we want to continue raising until we can make this, like, you know, IPO or bust. Because that comes out in conversations, and you would be surprised how many people haven't actually had those hard conversations with their co-founders. Okay, and the last thing, just be kind. We're all just trying to make it in this world. If you're not nice, especially when you hear those no's, because I know those no's are really hard and it can be really upsetting, and it can be very it can make people very upset. But like the more kind you are, and the more kind you are in your interactions, people remember that, right? And I think it can go a really, really long way. And so just remember to always be nice. All right, that's it.
Maria, the amount of knowledge bombs you just dropped on us is amazing. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to open this up to Q&A. Not a good time to pitch your startup. Not a good time to talk about your experience getting a no from a VC. Great time to ask about the VC process and some of the knowledge bombs that she just dropped. So I'm going to hand the microphone to John. If you got a question, raise your hand.
Hi, great presentation. And really specific, it was great. Just wondering, when you were talking about the team and how important that is, mm-hmm. how often does that lend itself to sort of more diverse people in the space, more unexpected people in the space? Or do you feel like if you're not the traditional Ivy League, you know, kind of what we think of as how VCs, mm-hmm. you know, fund, should you just skip the VC route altogether?
Oh, 100% no. it's not necessarily about your background. So I'll give you an example. So we just invested in a company called Lolly. It's a New York City-based company. They are basically Honey and Ebates, but for cryptocurrency. So instead of earning cash back, you can actually earn Bitcoin back. This founder, he went to University of North Carolina. I think he might have even like dropped out halfway through. And then he basically had a startup that he sold to Rakuten, Ebates, and which sold to Rakuten, and then he worked there for 8 years. And so this guy knew the online Chrome extension space better than anyone because he'd been working there for 8 years. So for him, we've ended up funding him, but part of it was he just knew this ecosystem way better than anyone else who was going to start off. So even if it's some Ivy League guy from HBS or whatever it is came and started, tried to build this, they didn't have the domain expertise that he had. And so for us, it's more about like, what experience have you gotten or who from the team can you bring to the table in order to make it interesting? So it doesn't necessarily mean about like your education, like, but we have founders of all diverse backgrounds, and really what matters most to us is sort of what experience you've had.
I have so many questions, but I'll just ask, why don't you guys lead and how do you get allocation in the rounds?
Yeah, so, okay, so you typically the way that it works, so your lead investor will come in and take a board seat. Our team is only six people, and two of them have other full-time jobs. And so there's really only four of us who can actually take board seats, and so for us it just doesn't make any sense to lead. The other thing is that it makes us just way more, I would say, flexible and friendly with other venture investors. And so the way that we get into rounds, we're not competing with anyone, right? And what we bring to the table is very different than what most, like, other traditional VCs. So our network is very different from some from the traditional Silicon Valley VCs. I would say they have like 90% overlap in their networks. We have access to an entirely different community. Also, other investors, they can be really great financial partners. They can be great operators, and they can tell you how to run your business. For us, our expertise is really on the marketing, branding, content creation, like messaging side. So that's just very, very different. And so typically that's how we end up coming in. We're like a very different part of the syndicate.
Morning, and thanks for the knowledge bombs. I'm sure I'm not alone in that I've thought of something, and then somebody else did it.
Yeah.
Round of laughter, applause, but I thought of Uber 25 years ago, but somebody else did it. I thought of Netflix. Yeah. Somebody else did it. My challenge has been, again, I'm probably not alone, in that I thought of something and somebody else did it. Why didn't I do it? I had an idea, but I was scared that somebody was going to steal it. I was scared that if I talked to potential partners to work with me, collaborate on the issue, they were going to steal it. You know, NDAs, confidentiality agreements, you can do all that. I could talk to a potential investor, you know, yourselves and so forth. I'd be worried that the idea was going to go away. Anyway, any advice about that issue? So that's question number one.
Yeah.
And then also you had the thing about the seed and venture class A and so forth. In terms of investor involvement with the company, when you first started talking about, you know, don't take the money if you can, you know, maybe do the MVP. But I've always heard so much about how, you know, investors contribute so much to, you know, guiding and helping that company develop in the right way, in the right course. So there's the pros and cons about, you know, taking the money. Mm-hmm. But if you could just talk about how involved investors are at the different rounds. But again, going back to that first thing about the IP and, you know, advice to, you know, young entrepreneurs who want to, you know, do something, you know, get over it. Perhaps it's just your, you know, get your ass hit in the pool.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think in general, most people are very, very, very lazy. Like, I think, like, the best founders wake up every single day and spend, whatever, 20 hours a day working on their business and figuring it out and, like, dealing with fires. And I think most people in general don't want that to be their lifestyle. So my recommendation to you is that most people, like, even if you explain your idea, most people are probably going to be a little bit too lazy to do it. Same thing with NDAs and investors. Like, it just adds so much friction in the process that it's like, does it really matter, right? And basically, the way that I would think about it is think about, like, what's the minimum that you can tell them that then they can't go and copy it? Because, I mean, everyone has an idea, but how you actually execute it is going to be proprietary to you, and you're going to have a very different vision of how to execute versus this person versus that person. So I think it's good to be more transparent, I think, with ideas, because then you can also talk to people about it. You can get their feedback and advice. So that's just my recommendation. In terms of investor involvement, so it depends on the fund and it depends on the firm. I would say first and foremost, most venture capitalists are just capital providers, right? Like that's the biggest function that they're providing for you and your company is the capital and is the money. After that, then you have different types of investors. So lead investors tend to sit on your board. If you have a board meeting once a quarter, that's a great place to get advice and feedback on how you're building. There's other investors who will let you come in and, you know, sit in their office, and anytime you have a problem, you can come and talk to them. But I would say, in general, you're the one building your business, and you can get guidance and advice and feedback from people and people who can help you, but you're going to be the one executing on a day-to-day basis, regardless of who your venture investor is. I was going to say something else. Hang on. The other thing I was going to say. So you can also what I recommend doing is you don't need venture investors to get good mentorship. There's tons of operators or people who are a little bit older and retired and are looking for interesting companies to help advise on. And so you can actually build a really smart and strong advisory network that doesn't require you to take venture capital money, right? And so you can get that same feedback and that same advice and that same mentorship without actually needing to take capital.
So going back to that issue of the IP mm-hmm. at my day job, which is a real estate finance investment company, I was engaged to work with a offshoring company to do an MVP. And we went back and forth about, again, protections. You know, it's one thing to have IP protection in the U.S., but it's another issue of how do you protect it when it goes offshore? Do you recommend working with offshore teams in, you know, Hyderabad?
I think it just depends on who it is, what their background is, who's worked with them in the past. I think I can't give you a good answer to that.
Hello, I have a quick question. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about what a lead investor means on the early stages of angel investors pre-seed. How do we find, what do they represent at the early stage?
Yeah, so at the early stages, I mean, like lead investor is typically the one who prices your round. So theoretically, you don't need a lead investor at the very, very early stages because it's like pretty straightforward. So you're going to raise $1 million on five or 500,000 on five million. Like you can kind of price it yourself. But at those early stages, the lead investors are primarily capital providers, and they're also going to introduce you to later capital. So when you're going to raise your pre-seed, what are the milestones that you need to hit in order to raise your seed? And so those investors, the angel investors and the pre-seed investors are going to be the ones who help guide you and tell you what the KPIs are that you need to hit in order to raise the subsequent rounds of financing.
Over here. Ed, I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the compensation structure and incentives within a VC firm. So for the GPs, limited partners, and perhaps business development reps, the thing that prompted that question is I thought it was interesting that you said that you like typically having one person work with a company that's looking for investment directly. I was wondering if that is due to something with compensation or incentives, but would also just be very curious to hear about, from your perspective, what you think the kind of the incentive structure is.
So it's a pretty straightforward fund structure. So the way it works is our investors give us capital. We return that capital back. So like, let's say we have a $100 million fund. We invest the $100 million. We give $100 million back to our investors. And then any profit above that, we split with them 80-20. So they get 80% of the profits and we get 20% of the profits. And so if, let's say we have a $100 million fund, we end up making $200 million. We return $200 million. We had 2x the fund. That means that the LPs get $100 million. That's like their initial investment back. And then they get another $80 million, which is $80 million of the $100 million profit that we made. And then we get to keep $20 million. And so the way that we call that carried interest, that 20%, the way that carried interest works within venture funds is every single partner or every single investment professional or team member, whoever it is, gets a small percentage of that. And so that's typically how venture investors are compensated. There's no, I mean, like BD, like, I don't really know about the BDR role, the business development rep role. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's more about like, so the way we have general partners, investment partners, platform people, and then Occasionally you'll have like venture partners and everyone's just compensated slightly differently, but in general, everyone's participating in that 20% profit share. But not specific to the deals you bring in. It's everyone within that collective. So like, let's say we have six partners. Our six partners are participating in the 20%, not the individual investments that they made.
Hi. I have a question about when you're evaluating a company as to whether you're going to invest in it. When they present their financial statements, is there a specific set of, I guess, year-to-year numbers and ratios as far as like debt to equity and, you know, assets and their capital structure? Is there a specific set of things that you look for among like the 19 or 25 different ratios that a company can present?
It depends on the stage, right? So if you're an early stage company and you like are pre-revenue, like, you know, who cares what your financials say, right? Because it's not going to matter. Like, you're not going to hit your projections or whatever number. Like, so at the later stages, yes, that becomes important. And depending on what the business is, there's different ratios that are going to be important, right? So if you're an asset-heavy business, like you're buying real estate properties, then your debt-to-asset ratio is going to be more important. But the thing that I would think more about, and the thing that I personally and Sound, I guess, cares about more about is what are the KPIs, right? So key performance indicators. And so you should have like the 3, 4, 5 KPIs that your business fundamentally like depends on. So I'll give you some examples. So if you're an enterprise software business, you care about your ARR, your annual recurring revenue, your net dollar retention, your customer churn, your LTV and CAC. Right. And so you should know those numbers off the top of your head. And what investors are really going to care about is how do you keep improving those metrics? And so if your churn is 10% a quarter today, how do you get it down to 5%? So I would focus less on like what the broader financial statements say and like looking at these specific ratios. It's really very, very company specific. And you should know what those important metrics that are going to change, like critical to your business are. And that's what investors are going to care about.
Thank you. So earlier you talked about like not raising funds, right?
Yeah.
What would you say to somebody, hypothetically, who didn't want to raise funds, right? So like, you know, you get caught up in every, you know, raise funds. Mm-hmm. I went to a conference yesterday up in San Francisco. It was by XL, raise funds. But like for some of us who don't want to raise funds, what would you say to that, to them?
Great. Right? Because, like, I mean, it all just depends on your own perspective, right? So, like, if you think that you can build a good product, maybe spend some, like, a little bit of your own investment into it and put $100,000 or $50,000 or $20,000 or get a grant or whatever it is, get alternative forms of financing, and you can build this into a great $10 million business. You own 100% of a $10 million business. Like that could change your life. And so the way that I think about it is like, what's most important to you? What are you optimizing for? And then also like, why are you selling 20% of your business? Because selling 20% of that's a very, very expensive cost of capital. And so you just have to align your outcomes with that 20. If I get this 20%, if I sell 20% of my business, I can 20X my business, right? And having that mentality, I think, is super important.
This is kind of a nerdy accounting and legal question or questions, but I think also super valuable for anyone going into this. Generally, these companies which are accepting all this funding are C corporations. Is like, when would a company in this VC stage be an LLC or even an S corp? And my second question is, I know it's kind of a very general question, but at which point would you start issuing stock options to the founders and the employees and everything?
Okay, so most companies are Delaware C corps, and that's just because from a legal perspective, it's easier for our like one, it's in Delaware because that's where it has like the most legal precedence, and then two, it's just the easiest form factor to issue securities and have outside investors and blah, blah, blah. So I don't actually know if companies transition into LLCs or S corps. It's out of my domain expertise. We have lawyers for that. But what was your second question?
Stock
Stock options. Oh, okay. So when you start a company, 100% is owned by the founders, or like, you know, you have a cap table. Typically, I would say that in every single round of financing, you open up an what's called an option pool. Basically, it's a pool of phantom equity that you can then grant to employees as they come on. And you know, you have a you bring on someone, you want to give them 1%. Like you take that from the option pool. With every single subsequent round of financing, you can it's what's called refresh your option pool. And so that just means part of the round or part of the dilution goes towards giving equity to employees. And so that ranges on average from, call it, 5 to 15% on average. And so typically in every single round, you're giving, you're reserving 5 to 15%, or you're building up a 5 to 15% option pool for your employees.
Hi, I just wanted to find out from you, what's been sort of the evolution of the criteria that you guys are using to make investments? Because some of the feedback that I keep hearing is that it's getting much harder. Some of it is also looking for traction much earlier on. Is that been your experience?
Yeah, I think in general, like if we go back 5 or 10 years, right, it's much easier today to start a company than it was 5 or 10 years ago, because you have more infrastructure, you have more software and applications and different ways to build it. So I think because of that, the milestones have gone out further. And so if you're going to raise a seed, you need to have a product, you need to have some traction, you need to have like some people using it, maybe people paying for it, whatever it might be. And I think part of that is because it's become so much more cost efficient and easier to build better products. Whereas back in the day, like you had to raise a seed round because you needed to build your network hardware infrastructure, right? But today all those costs are gone. And so you're like the things that you need to hit in order to raise that capital, those milestones I think have just gone out further.
Relate to that.
Yeah.
I know that you guys are doing Series A and B.
Yes.
So if in case we qualify for Angel, whatever, would you be able to recommend, or we have to go find our own?
So there's a massive community in LA of investors who do angel, pre-seed, and seed. And actually, if you just look online and you search Los Angeles investors, like there are tons of people who have put lists of angel investors and pre-seed funds. So I can't make that recommendation, but you can go online and identify those people. I think builtinla.com has a lot of those lists, and there's other places that have those types of resources.
Hi, Maria.
Hi.
One last question. We've had a lot of VCs come speak before, and you've given some really good information. But one thing that I've noticed is that VCs, one of the roles that you guys play, is almost like a matchmaker between the LPs and then the investments that you make. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the diversity of LPs? You know, are these mainly high net worth individuals, mm-hmm. private equity funds, private family offices, or whatever the case may be? Because that might give the audience some idea of who's looking for these kind of investments.
Yeah, that's a great question. So our LP base, I mean, every investor, every fund has a different investor base. Our specific LP base, so we work with ultra high net worth individuals. So like Mark Benioff, for example, is one of our anchor. He's like one of the largest LPs in our fund. We work mostly with ultra high net worth individuals. We work with some family offices. So family offices are basically financial advisors that pool together capital from many different wealthy families, and they aggregate them and they manage that money for them. Then you also have your institutions and endowments. So like your Harvard endowment, your Yale endowment, LACMA has its own fund that it invests. And so you have these different types of institutional investors. When you have institutional LPs, it typically or occasionally can limit the types of investments you can make. And so institutional investors don't want to invest in cannabis typically, or alcohol, or guns. And so you have a little bit of restrictions on sort of what you can do. With an LP base that's mostly ultra high net worth individuals, you can do whatever you want to do.
Cool. Fantastic. Thank you. Let me get a photo of you. Please jump down here. Step down here and face me. in Pasadena. We're going to prove that we are amazing and fun and exciting. I like to do that by having everybody photobomb. So your marks, get set, go photobomb. Good, yeah, good. Thank you so much, Maria. Amazing. Before you go, one last question. You've given us so much good information here, and it's very helpful for the innovation community. Is there anything that we can do to help you?
Yeah, if you guys have incredible companies or know incredible entrepreneurs, we want to meet them.
The Friday Coffee Meetup podcast is brought to you by Echo Factory. Learn more about how Echo Factory can help your business achieve rapid, sustainable growth at echo-factory.com. And get all the details about upcoming Friday Coffee Meetup episodes at fridaycoffeemeetup.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.